from the American Tobacco Historic District. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. There's an old joke Woody Allen retells in the movie Annie Hall. The guy confides in his doctor that his brother is crazy, thinks he's a chicken. Doctor says, well, why don't you get him some help? Man says, I can't. I need the eggs. That's how Woody Allen feels about love relationships. Irrational, they drive us crazy, but really and truly deep down inside, we all need the eggs. So today on The State of Things, getting the eggs we need, rotten or sunny side up, relationships are necessary, even vital, some experts say, to our health. Are we better off when our couplings are long-term? Is there a secret to making a good relationship last? Is it affection? Is it humor? Could it be separate vacations? It's Valentine's Day, and we're making our way through the chocolate and the hearts and the flowers to consider the heart of the matter at hand, coupling. Why do we do it, and what does it mean to do it right? We welcome your calls this hour at 877-962-9862. You don't have to be an expert. After all, we just quoted Woody Allen. You don't have to know a thing about it. Just give us a call at 877-962-9862. Joining us first is Liza Wieland. Liza is the author of two novels, two short story collections, as well as a new collection of poetry called Near Alcatraz. She also contributed an essay called Preserved in Salt, How Emerald Live and Egyptology Are Saving My Marriage. That's part of a new anthology called Why I'm Still Married. Welcome, Liza, to the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Your essay, Preserved in Salt, explains how your marriage manages an intermittent long-distance separations between the coast of North Carolina and Fresno, California. But the essay also touches on the fact that you married in your mid-30s after having lived alone for a long while. What kind of adjustment is that?
It was a big adjustment. Suddenly there was this person in the house that never went away. But because I married somebody who's also a writer, it was a little like making the conversation that always went on in my head go on out loud with another person, making it a little more sane-sounding. So an adjustment sort of, you know, in terms of space, but not so much in terms of mental space.
You know, I want to follow up with you on this notion of the conversation in your head and making it right, particularly when you wait so long to get married. Is it more difficult? I mean, I suppose it's hard to compare. But when you have expectations, those expectations grow and they get locked in. It seems to put a burden on both of you, doesn't it?
I suppose so. I feel like I didn't have that many expectations. The other thing that happens if you wait that long is that you come up against all the examples of the things you can't have and the people that turn out to be wrong. So one by one, your expectations sort of fall dead on the ground.
You talked about the difficult adjustment. Was this adjustment difficult for your husband as well?
I think it probably was, although he'd been married before and been involved with somebody in between and had two daughters. So he had a house full for, you know, a long time.
And you met. He was your student, actually. You were teaching. That sounds like a pretty good story. Tell us.
It is a good story. It's in the essay. And actually, we met just about 10 years ago right now. The spring semester in Fresno State, 1996, and there was this guy in my class who was not so old, but older than most of the rest of the students, and he was very eager, answered all the questions, wanted to turn in the first story, and had an interesting habit of correcting me, you know, sort of forcefully but tastefully, and he just sort of caught my eye as somebody who was smart and literate, and actually he was a truck driver at the time, and I had made, because my family was in Atlanta, I had made a lot of cross-country journeys on my own, and we ended up talking about highways and highway experiences for a lot of the first times we met in the office. So we had, interestingly enough, a long-distance connection before the long-distance part of the marriage.
How would you describe the effect the separation has had on your marriage?
It made it better. It didn't take me long, 5 months, to realize that I never wanted to live apart from this person again. So I don't know if I'd recommend it as part of marriage counseling, but
well, and you talk too in the essay about the reminders when you watch Emerald and a little bit about Egyptology, and we'll go into more detail about the connection between that and saving your marriage. But the idea that it reminded you in many ways of the life that you lived before, and it was a life that was not so happy.
Right. I was ready to be in a full-on, full-time relationship. And I suppose that's one of the expectations I had, was finding somebody that I could really live with all the time, you know, every minute.
Well, here's the thing that seems to ruin a lot of relationships, that people go into it with expectations about what's going to happen now that we're married or that we're committed and we're going to live together. And those expectations sometimes are a little bit far-fetched, and the reality sets in and tends to collapse a marriage. Is that something you had to deal with at any point?
I think probably in small ways. You just sort of think that, I mean, everybody thinks this, it's not anything profound, that every day will be like the premarital days, the courtship days, when he comes in with flowers, or, you know, when there are no fights, there are only smiles and happiness. And it's just, you know, human life is not like that. My single life wasn't like that every day. So I don't know that I expected it that much, but...
We're talking about love, marriage, and committed relationships, the power they have to, in some cases, researchers say, make us feel better and live healthier lives. And you can give us a call at 877-962-9862 with your stories about romance and committed relationship. Liza, you have a collection of poetry near Alcatraz, and it includes a poem called Marriage. Will you read it for us?
Yes, I will. Marriage. You will forget the ring, or bring the wrong kind, a hoop of fire, a burning cogless wheel. Afterward, you want to go where the news will never reach you, and no one says, pointing, that woman following you, your wife. We will lie side by side on the blue edge of the afternoon, and you tell me when the child is born, you will throw her into the air, saying, fly. She'll learn, her voice will grow black, the ravens, her mother's. When I turn away from you, you will look at me surprised as we listen to a silence so great it betrays our heart's mechanical whine.
Liza Wieland reading from the poem Marriage. It's from her new collection called Near Alcatraz. Is that something you wrote after you were married?
No, I wrote that before, long before, actually, as I watched other friends of mine get married and not, you know, necessarily have bad marriages, but the reality was... a little darker, as this poem might show.
And when you read it now, do you have sort of new ideas about the poem as you look at this today?
Yeah, I do. I think there are those silences between married partners, but they're not necessarily so dark and full of suspicion and hatred. Sometimes there's just quiet. And I'm also interested in the fact that I sort of... I presaged my own daughter. You know, the child is born, you'll throw her into the air. I had no idea I would have a daughter, and that's what I had. So.
Now your daughter is 5 years old, and you split your time between the coast of North Carolina and Fresno. Explain how that split works.
Well, I teach at Fresno State, and my husband teaches at Pitt Community College in Greenville, North Carolina, and we both have tenured full-time jobs. Sometimes we can take a year off. He can take a year off. I can take a year off, but... occasionally, there will be a semester or perhaps a year when it's just not possible because of scheduling or other faculty needs. So we hope not to have to do it much more, but we did it that once.
Is it worse as time goes on, or do you learn certain tricks for managing the long-term relationship, and does it get a little better maybe?
You mean during the separation?
During the separations, yeah.
Yeah. I think we learned very quickly during the first one that you have to stay in constant touch. The secret was talking every night on the phone, mm-hmm. And we emailed a couple times a day, and my daughter talked to her father every night too. So it was that never letting the thread, you know, snap or be cut at all every day.
And did you find that because I happen to be working down here for the next few months, and I work 5 days and then go back up to Northern Virginia where my wife is still working. And what I find is that it's talking about nothing that really makes it feel like home. It's saying mm-hmm. stuff that really doesn't matter at all. It's the no big news, you know, nonsense that goes on for 45 minutes in the conversation. Makes you feel married.
Right, that's true, and that's in a way that's why those phone calls were so comforting, was because they happened every night. There wasn't a big, you know, huge conflagration to discuss every day. Actually, the bad stuff we emailed about.
So give yourself a little time to
no
think.
Voice.
Yeah.
Didn't want to hear it. But it was just how you doing, what are you having for dinner? I mean, often the subject was, what are you having? What are you having?
Yeah.
So
yeah, you are what you eat.
And, it was great.
You're changing along the way, and you got to know what's going on. Well, I understand that you also have another poem that's acted as a kind of a love poem, a potion. It's a poem that you wrote at a friend's wedding. Would you read that?
I do. Yes. It was commissioned for a friend's wedding about 20 years ago, and I've read it at several weddings, and I'm happy to say that all those people are still married.
So it works. Okay.
Can you
read it for us? Maybe you'll cast a spell on all of us. Go ahead.
Okay. It's called For the Journey You Will Want. A road on fire with so much it wants to lead to, clothing made of white light, which will be your sail by day and your lookout by night. A loaf of bread which, in hard times, can double as a house of soft pillows. Your hands, which will save you with their talents, find you honest work in strange cities, speak your clearest thoughts into other held hands. A voice to whisper pardons and to sing, which is how you part the air and move through it. Water, which is the riddle you live by, swimming the shallows, rowing the deeps, knowing the difference. Fierce memory for ballast. A clear eye and some single vision that makes it the more clear. An absence of destination. The blazing wheel of your minds grinding back and forth over your map. A rising wind from the north to muffle shouts of warning, to cover your tracks, to chill you until your bones strike together on the willing tinder of your hearts. A road on fire with so much it wants to lead to. The good luck to go on, finding each other again and again, willing, without being asked, to shift silently, wisely in the tent at night to make vast room for your arrival.
Liza Wieland from her new book of poems called Near Alcatraz. We're talking about love today. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Valentine's Day, and our minds turn to the subject of love, romantic love, long-term relationships, marriage, and the like. And we're talking with author Liza Wieland about her essay from the new anthology, Why I'm Still Married, and taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Are you still married, and why? Talk to us about relationships, committed relationships, and love relationships. Today on the program, 877-962-9862. Joining us now are Dr. Redford Williams, the director of the Behavioral Medicine Research Center at Duke University Medical Center. Dr. Williams, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you, Frank.
Also, Scott Hewler, author of Defining the Wind, and June Spence, author of Change Baby. Scott and June are married to each other. Welcome to you as well.
Hi, Frank.
And we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Dr. Williams, let me start with you and talk about long-term monogamous relationships. Better for you, for your health?
Yes, there's been a lot of research showing that people who are married, particularly people who are married and have a good, close relationship with good communications, do live longer. The effect is stronger for men than it is for women, but there is an increase in longevity in married women compared to unmarried women. One very specific example of the kind of effect that marriage, particularly marriage with good communication, can give you. We followed up a group of patients at Duke several years ago, about 1,900 of them, who had gone through the coronary angiography lab. So they all had some severe heart disease that had been documented. And those patients who were either married or had a close confidant that they could share things with, or both, didn't seem to matter, about 18% of those patients died in 5 years. Now, that's about par for people with severe heart disease. In contrast, those patients who were not married and also said they had no one close enough that they felt they could share troubling things with, 50% of those people were dead within 5 years. So a marriage with a close relationship where you can share things and talk about things that are bothering you, or a relationship outside of marriage that gives you this kind of ability to talk about stuff that bothers you, for people with heart disease, is really very, very healthy.
And it's the relationship that's the thing. And does it matter, I suppose, or did you check for whether or not living together is
crucial? It was kind of interesting. The people who were married but said, no, I don't have a confidant, had the same protection as the people who were not married but did have a confidant. Mm. So we think there were two things going on here. The people who were married had somebody who, when they weren't taking their meds or looked a little gray around the gills, mm-hmm. said, "You better get to the doctor. You know, you got to eat this healthy food, or you know, go out and take your walk." And that kind of healthy nudge factor was going there. Whereas the people who were not married but did have a confidant, when stuff was bothering them, they had somebody they could talk with about it, and it really kind of reduced the stress, we feel, that was going on.
So, Scott and June, did you get married just to live a little longer? Is that the idea?
We got married for the ice cream.
Does it, how old were you when you were married? Were you sort of well along? Or?
Yeah. Old.
Yeah, you're a couple
he
old guys?
He was really old.
I was 44, and you were 34. So, yeah. So we were... And I think I may be the only person in this room who had the experience of having a lousy marriage to teach me how good I have it now. And I can tell
you're
you
so
that
lucky.
It's true. There's no doubt about that.
Well, no, I had a lousy marriage once too.
Oh,
but
and so
put to the same person. It's better now.
Oh, wow.
In fact, we are on about our fourth or fifth marriage right now.
Wow. Well, and the three of you, the fourth or fifth marriage with the same person,
yes.
which gets the whole, I guess, the idea of renewal. The fact is that you're probably, if the relationship's going to work, you're not married to the same person every day.
That's right. It changes. When we were first married, I was the husband, she was the wife, she stayed home, I went out and killed the mastodon and so forth, and I told her what to do, and uh-huh. she kind of nurtured me. After a while, she decided she wanted to be, you know, kind of out there doing stuff too.
What about social expectations? You're both professional, Scott and June, and you know, you sort of were raised and you probably came of age at a time when men's roles had already begun to change in women's roles. Do you have to negotiate that, especially in a professional marriage, when two of you share the same profession, going into the marriage?
I have found that we really haven't. I mean, we share our feelings about money and our feelings about our work are so similar that we've found it very easy. We're both kind of skinflints, so we don't like to spend money. And so we both hoard our money, so neither of us is running out and making the other person angry by spending money. And we're both really committed to our work, and I think committed to the work of the other. We both want to support the work. I think the world of what June's doing, and she seems to like it when I write too, so
she's smiling. She's not nodding.
I agree with all that, but I was going to say, yeah, we negotiate all the time.
Because
we seem to have to, just given whatever is going on that particular period of time with someone's work. The other person maybe has to do some adjustment to make up for that, or to pick up the slack or whatever.
Well, we'll talk about mutually exclusive perceptions in a moment, but I want to go to the phones right now. Cheryl is on the line from Greensboro. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello. How's everybody? I'm really enjoying the show today. I called in because I'm a family mediator by training, so I usually see the other end of this when things haven't worked out. And I've also recently married, and what I'm finding is a lot of the things that I learned from research and things I teach my students, I've had to throw out the window as a married man.
Is that, now, for instance? What's one of the bromides that you swore by, and all of a sudden, wait a minute, doesn't work?
One of the big things is about how you communicate, you know, iMessages and you messages and all these things that are very useful. And because she knows me and knows who I am, she sees it coming. So I'm trying to reflect feelings, and she's like, wait, don't counsel me. You know, talk to me as a husband. Don't talk to me as a helper. I don't know if it's the same. If it's the same for everybody that comes from this sort of professional background, but I've had to start over from scratch.
Wow.
And that's actually been very refreshing for me, because now work doesn't come home and home doesn't go to work.
That's very interesting. So you're sending a message to Venus, and there she is next to you on Mars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so not so much as that, but it's a... I don't know. I like the way that you're sort of mixing the science and the romance, because somewhere between those two things is where most people are.
Mm-hmm.
And especially seeing the relationships that haven't worked out, what I've found is there was one thing that went wrong for everybody. Mm-hmm. Now, that one thing is different for different people, but there's something that started, whether it was unrealistic expectations in the beginning or it was... you know, you never took out the trash when I asked you to.
And sort of,
but there seems to be one thing that happened that changed everything.
Well, we're going to talk more about that. I appreciate your call, Cheryl. Our line is 877-962-9862. It's the love line today. Liza Wieland, I guess one of the things Cheryl said struck me. There was a part in your essay where you talked about having cold feet. Your husband-to-be, your student at the time, asks you out, and you're thinking, oh, wait a minute, I can't do this. I can't go have him as my student. He's still young. And then you hear a Sarah McLachlan song that changes your mind. Tell us a little bit about that moment, because I have a question about sort of our sensitivity to this kind of thing when we're feeling this way.
Well, first of all, I should make it clear that he was no longer my student. I have to make that perfectly clear. And I'd heard this song. I mean, it was very popular on the radio, and I think I was just I was sunbathing, actually. I remember the moment perfectly, and looking for the final reason not to go, and the complications I've previously mentioned. And the song was just so clearly pushing in the opposite direction, saying, you know, if you never, ever take a chance, if you just let things pass you by, one of them is going to be your whole life. And I just thought, this is a place. You know, I just knew it was serious because I felt so strongly about the song. And I went.
Well, as an artist, as somebody who has to be responsive to the muse, do you think there's something about the condition of being in this heightened state of love, when it's love and affection and romance and all that's making you crazy, that we're more perceptive to art, to messages?
Absolutely. All the fine, you know, nerve endings are going, and everything is making its impression, and that's what happened.
Redford Williams, what's the science behind that?
Well, as a matter of fact, there are people, there's a woman actually at NYU in New York who has been doing brain scans of people who are just fallen in love. And there are certain parts of the brain, I'll just say anterior cingulate cortex.
Oh, yeah, it's right here.
Yeah,
right, okay, go ahead.
That do different things when you're in love. And of course, there are hormones that go. Oxytocin is a hormone that kind of pours out when you're in a close relationship. In fact, there are even studies with prairie voles. Prairie voles are little kind of mouse-like creatures that live in the desert. And compared to the mountain voles, the prairie voles are very close to each other. They're very faithful to each other and form monogamous pair bonds. In other words, they get married and stay married. Mm. And they have lots of oxytocin going. And for the female prairie vole to bond to a new male prairie vole, she has to have a big spritz of oxytocin going in her brain. And when there is, she'll form a bond that sticks. So there's hormones and there's brain changes, and you feel real good. And part of the reason you feel good is the oxytocin, and probably some endorphins are going too.
Well, Scott Hewler and June Spence, does your
oxytocin.
Does your oxytocin make you better writers?
I hope so. I think so. I think it's... Yeah, because that's a lonesome occupation.
Well, have you noticed in writing, and you're not, I mean, you're obviously not always writing love poetry, clearly, but the question is whether or not your creative output is affected by your presence or absence. Have you noticed that?
Well, we've had periods of long absence through the years for various reasons, and it kind of, you know, you can do a sort of lovelorn, lonesome, but also lots of extra free time to maybe you get a little more work done then, but... No, I think it's better to be together.
Well, we both finished books when we had been apart for a year, and then we moved back in together, back into the same city and into the same apartment, coincidentally.
Very small.
And we both finished books that year, so we obviously don't hurt each other, and I think we help each other a lot.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I'm writing right now a book that has to do with the Odyssey, and so, of course, I'm thinking about Penelope and... June is a great sort of, you know, this is my Penelope, and I get to make all those comparisons and think about stuff. And
he also went away a whole lot researching that book while I was pregnant, and so there was a lot of that going on.
Do you unstitch his garments at night?
Yeah.
877-962-9862. Kathleen is on the line from Chapel Hill. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello there.
Hi. You have a question for us?
Not a question.
Uh-huh.
You wanted to hear about marriages?
I sure do.
Okay. Well, I'm married 36 years. My husband's a scientist at UNC, and I'm an international flight attendant, and it's worked very well. I'm gone 3 days a week. He has his time, I have my time, and when we come back, it's very romantic, even with the children.
How many kids?
Two, but they're grown.
Have you had to negotiate that? I mean, has it changed over time, or did you have to at one point sit down and talk about, hey, this is not working, we're going to have to change this or that in your 36 years of experience?
No, it worked very well, because when our second daughter cried for a year, I prayed for my flight, so I got a nice break, and then he became mom, but I did adjust my schedule. At that time, I would fly Sunday afternoon, and then I would come home on Tuesday, so, and then we always had some wonderful people, caretakers that were like grandmothers, so it worked very well, but he would be mom, you know what, he'd pick them up at 5, and cook dinner. No, usually they went out to eat. But
so apparently you weren't praying to the same God, because I'm thinking when she's crying, he's making the same prayer, and he ended up with her.
Oh, no. When I'm home, he didn't hear the baby's cry.
That is bad.
Isn't that funny?
Thanks for the call, Kathleen. 877-962-9862. Liza Whelan, you write in your essay about Nefertiti as part of the, you know, sort of the balance and the effect of helping keep your marriage together, keep you sane while you were apart. And in that is the whole notion of death and rebirth as part of, you know, part of the story of Nefertiti as well and the Egyptian story. And I wonder to what extent what Kathleen is talking about, the ability to sort of give something up, and we discover that the thing we gave up, that little death that we had to die in order to accommodate a partner, is the thing that leads to rebirth and refreshes a marriage. It shouldn't be the thing we're afraid of in marriage, giving up, sacrifice.
Right, right. That's really true, I think. And it's as simple as absence makes the heart grow fonder. But also in the essay, I'm interested in the idea of immortality. And I say in another place that immortality is, in essence, having the thing that's gone be present. And that's what I had to do to make him be there. You know, he was gone, but he had to be sort of this odd immortal.
Mm-hmm.
It was also in the house at the same time.
Much of that immortality, Dr. Williams, do we find in giving up the things that turned out to be desires? These are the things that enslaved us, and when we give them up, that's the rebirth. And maybe to what extent is that actually improving us, not simply in relationship to another person?
Yeah, well, I think that's a very good point. I think you become freer. You become actually more in control of yourself when you're able to give up things. One of the hardest things I had to give up in my marriage to Virginia was always being in control and telling her what to do and checking after her to make sure she wasn't cooking the spaghetti too much or not cooking it enough or what have you. And she finally got kind of tired of that. And as Lisa was just saying, I had to come to a point where I had to give up that control. Now, I still am that way. But the fact that I'm working on it and trying to change and trying to give up some of the control has made all the difference in the world. I haven't gotten there yet, but the fact that I'm making the effort makes Virginia much more able to put up with my occasional right. need to be in control.
And it could bring your blood pressure down as
it
well,
does
now
indeed.
That you don't have to control every living thing. And then, there, of course, there's the beauty of knowing that someone is willing to die for you.
Yeah, or to change.
I think one of the nice things for June and me is having gotten married later is that you're so ready to give up all of those difficult ones. You decide, fine, you steer. Here's the wheel. I'm getting the vaccine and going to sleep, you know.
Well, is that true? Because we hear so many people say that the hard part about marriage is we've gotten these habits. We have this way of doing things, how to, you know, screw the cap on the toothpaste and how much bathroom space I need. You know, that's the hard thing, that people aren't ready to give those things up.
I don't know. We had two households full of junk that we were ready to clear out.
Burn it.
And it was nice to negotiate after a long time of being on your own and making all those decisions. It was a lot more fun to talk that over with somebody else and know that your ingrained way wasn't always the right or the best way. And there was some other ways to do things. I don't know. I've liked that a lot. And we've kept that with our son. We've kept that going with... We don't know what's right, and we'll go out and do our own. We'll read all our books, and we'll talk to all our friends, and we'll figure it out. And then we come back and powwow, and we come to some understanding.
I also find that some of the things that maybe the other one's doing that, sort of on the surface starts to get under your skin and bother you, you suddenly realize,
like,
I know I do. not that June would do anything. I'm sure. I'm just talking about things that I must do. That
you have a friend who has this problem.
Yes.
That I find, I think that we both think, you know, all this is really a little example that she's around, you know, and it reminds me during the day if I'm doing something, you know, cleaning up something or doing that, I'm thinking, oh, she's never. And I think, well, no, if this is what it costs to have her, it's really worth it. It makes me just glad. It reminds me, hey, this is great. I get to have June around, and that's a pretty good thing. So,
well, it's really a call to recognize how self-centered you become. I notice after a week, the first things when Joanne and I finally get back together are the little irritations and how magnified they are. And I think, my goodness, in 1 week I've become extremely self-centered.
I think it's also probably a good idea for couples who never are apart to maybe occasionally, as we've heard, you know, absence makes the heart go fonder. And when you're apart, you know, you begin to appreciate the things you like about the other person, and the things that annoy you so much aren't there annoying you. And I think if couples took a little vacation apart, you know, occasionally, you know, go on a trip, get away, I think when you get back together, I think it could be healthy for marriage.
Well, we'll talk about that, the sort of a couple of weeks apart, and the difference between that and now working couples and building stress, independent stresses, and what happens when those two come back to the household as we continue our talk about love on the state of things today, particularly the effects of long-term love, with us poet and writer Liza Wieland, Dr. Redford Williams, and the husband and wife authors, I was going to say author team, but really independent authors and husband and wife Scott Hewler and June Spence. Just ahead, more of your phone calls at 877-962-9862 on the state of things. Stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking this hour about coupling, committed relationship, why it's good for you, and how you can be good at it. Dr. Redford Williams is with us, a behavioral medicine expert, as are Scott Hewler and June Spence, an honest-to-goodness married couple, really live in the studio today. Liza Wieland is with us as well, an essayist and poet who wrote about marriage and her marriage for the anthology Why I'm Still Married. She's on the line from NPR in Washington, taking your calls at 877-962-9862. So just before the break, Dr. Williams, we talked about the impact now of couples sort of building stress, and we talked earlier about the benefits of being in a committed relationship of any time. But there are some downsides. There's some bad news in those statistics as well.
Yes. People who are in, particularly women, but men as well, who are in marriages that are troubled, where there's lots of conflict, definitely have health problems. There was a study done in Sweden a few years ago where women who had a lot of stress in their marriage were two or three times more likely to come down with heart disease, or if they already had heart disease, to have another cardiac event of some sort. And whereas if they had stress at work, it had only a small effect. So the marriage has a bigger impact than what goes on bad at work. A very specific example, studies done by a husband-wife research team at Ohio State, Jan Kikoek-Glaser and Ron Glaser. They have couples come into their lab and engage in an argument about some conflict-related topic, or talk about something that's a more pleasant topic for them. And before they do the argument or the pleasant talk, they make little blisters, put a little suction cup on their forearm and make little blisters. And would you believe that following the argument, it takes a lot longer for those blisters to heal than it does after the pleasant conversation? So here's a very concrete example of how conflict in marriage, particularly arguing about something, literally affects your immune system in ways that causes wounds to heal more slowly. And it's not just the skin, but, you know, we have other wounds in our body. Like when our blood pressure goes up, we get little wounds in our arteries. And if they don't heal...
Well, and it's interesting to hear you say that your blood pressure goes up, but the effect of a conflict within a marriage is more profound than other stresses in workplace, et cetera. 877-962-9862. If you want to join our conversation about love today, Bill is on the line from Winston. Hi, Bill.
Yes. My question is, I'd like to ask your guest, what is the relationship or the effect on a couple of, for lack of a better term, I guess, religious spirituality? Sometimes I've noticed it can be very good holding a couple together. Sometimes it drives a couple apart. And I'm not just talking about the spouses or significant others or whatever coming from different traditions, but even within the same tradition. And I would just like to ask your guests what they think of that.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Well, everybody's looking at me, so I guess I'll start.
You're the doc.
I'll only
you
start.
Put the suction cup on our wrist bar in the kneelers and see what
the
happens.
The bowls and everything.
My guess, Bill, is that when there's conflicts that seem to be around religion, that there are probably conflicts in that relationship anyway that we're going to show up. So it may surface around things that have to do with religious practice or what have you. But my guess is that that relationship has got some other problems going on. I never say anything absolutely all the time, but that would be my guess. I think sharing of religious beliefs, spirituality, can be a very strong thing, a very positive thing in a marriage. And I would guess it's probably something else going on there.
Scott, yeah.
I think that squares with our experience. I'm a sort of what we would call a high holidays Jew, where, you know, I have a sort of a nice, comfortable arms length relationship
with
my
Judaism. I'm a lapsed Baptist.
And when we were talking about getting married, June was the one who felt that we should have a sort of a spiritual component, a religious component. And she said, "You're the one who practices your religion, so it should be Jewish." And so we had a Jewish marriage, and we had Jewish rituals concerning the birth of our son. And so it's something that we're very much together on. And I think you're right that it demonstrates that we negotiate pretty well rather than, you know, and certainly I don't want June not to practice the aspects of her religion that she wishes to practice. I don't want our son to feel like, you know, we're a Jewish household, and so mom has to sort of sneak outside to have her Christmas tree or something.
Well,
like that.
But June, have you picked up on how to make him feel guilty now?
Yeah. he owes me so big time.
Let's go back to the phones now. Jamie's on the line from Durham. Hi, Jamie.
Hi. Yes, I got a quick question. I had two previous marriages where I was married to Italian women when I was in the service overseas, and those marriages were both pretty rough. I think most marriages where a person's married to a foreign national generally just don't work out. I had a good friend who was a general officer in the Italian army. He sat me down. He pretty much told me that my odds of my marriages working out were pretty slim, and he turned out to be correct. But I'm married now to an American woman I met in the service as well. And my marriage is really good, except for one thing. I now have post-traumatic stress disorder, and my marriage is pretty rough at times because of that. And I'm wondering if there's a way of maybe enhancing my marriage. You know, I go to counseling and therapy at the Veterans Hospital for myself, but my wife refuses to get involved in any of that, and I'm wondering if there's any types of things I might be able to do for myself or for my marriage.
All right, well, let's take a look at that, and not in the particular, Jamie, but I appreciate your call, because I know we can't really deal with particular problems, but it does raise the issue of sort of when we negotiate, when we, as you say, you know, a problem arises, maybe it's about religion, it points to something deeper, and we find it. How do we know when it's worth negotiating, and how do we know when these are truly irreconcilable differences?
Right, and how do you negotiate? That's something that isn't taught in school or maybe even in marriage classes. It sounds, well, when there's a difference in Pete, whether you're going to get involved in working together on your PTSD or in anything, I suggest, Virginia and I suggest in our work that you engage in dialogues. And the dialogue approach is that you give each person a certain amount of time. You can even time it with your kitchen timer. It could be 5 minutes or whatever you agree on. And you do your take on this issue. I feel that we should do this or whatever. You have 5 minutes to just say what you have to say about it. The other person during that time practices good listening skills. They keep quiet. They look like they're interested in what you're saying.
look at you,
well,
lean forward,
harder.
Pay attention. and thirdly, they when you're finished, they tell you what they've heard you say, not their take on it, but, well, what I hear you saying is this. And then you trade places, and the other person talks for 5 minutes. You keep quiet, pay attention, and tell them what they had to say. These are the three rules of listening. Keep quiet, pay attention, and tell the other person what you heard. They're easy. Anybody can do that. It's behavior. The fourth one is a little harder. You have to be prepared to be changed by what you hear, at least be open to the possibility. So do this. You talk for 5 minutes about the issue. She talks for 5 minutes about the issue. You feedback what you've heard, and you drop it at that point. Come back the next day and repeat it, the same thing. And if you do this, what will happen likely over a few iterations, a few days of this, one of you is going to start moving toward the other.
Well, let me ask you about this, because there's something I could infer from what Jamie said, a reluctance perhaps on his wife's part to even acknowledge that PTSD is a problem. There is the listening can lead to change. That can be scary, and maybe that's the hard part. But for some, it's the speaking. It's the idea of saying anything out loud to express what I'm feeling is the first step toward change, and I'm not willing to do that.
Well, if you're not willing to do that, then you've got a problem. If you're not willing to even engage in the process to give it a shot, then that's, you know, that's a problem.
We're not going to give up on them that easily.
No,
we'll think it through.
Give it a try.
Yeah.
There's that whole thing about he was saying that his wife refused to go to therapy with him, and that's such a sort of scary thing. It's like,
sure. If
you won't even address it, you know, then where do you go with it?
But maybe you just go, because you
right,
that's
exactly.
All you can't make
well,
the other person.
Well, there's lots of intermediate steps between showing up, you know, the therapist and just starting to talk about it. And right. What I'm saying is if your wife will just be willing to engage in this dialogue, it's important to keep the structure. You even want to write it down and agree on it beforehand so it doesn't get out of hand.
Don't forget the first caller. This is exactly what his wife forbid him to do at home.
Liza, have you run into problems like this in terms of communications or issues like this in the marriage where one of you is the one who likes to talk about it and the other one kind of keeps to themselves?
I think in general I'm the one that likes to talk about it, whatever the it is. But I don't know. We've come a long way in terms of listening to one another and acknowledging that the other is speaking. I mean, it's we began in certain roles. I mean, I was the teacher, and he was the student, and I was used to be listened to, and not interrupted, and hand was raised. And I mean, I didn't expect him to do that, but it was. And I talk about this in the essay. It's interesting how gender roles sort of throw that dynamic on its head anyway. And I think what ends up happening is that the sort of traditional, or at least how I was raised, traditional male, maybe a little more dominant, ends up evening out the teacher-student role in our case, so that we ended up kind of on the same level as both prairie voles.
Yeah.
It was okay.
Dr. Williams.
This listening goes both ways, you know. I mean, the husband needs to learn to listen, but the wife needs to learn to listen too. And that kind of reminded me of a saying: if a man says something in the forest, and his wife's not there, is he still wrong?
877-962.
It goes both ways.
9862. Elizabeth is on the line from Raleigh. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I wanted to just make a comment about marriages that last. In my experience, it seems to me that what my friends' relationships that fall apart are missing is kindness. It seems to me that if we're willing to be kind to another person, then they're a lot more receptive to us as individuals, and they will be kind to us. And that sort of generates this wonderful place that you want to be and you want to stay.
All right. Thank you for that, Elizabeth. Scott, you were shaking your head.
I think that's absolutely, it's staggeringly true.
I suppose you want kindness now.
And there's even research that documents this. John Gottman, a marriage researcher in the University of Washington, brings newly married couples into what he calls his love lab and has them spend, you know.
Oh, we have a love lab.
It's a efficiency apartment. They live for a weekend and they record and video and tape record everything.
And he writes it off, no doubt. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And what he has found is that marriages that last, the interchanges between the couple, the positives, the kindnesses, compared to the put-downs and the negatives, if the kindnesses and the positives are not on a ratio of 5 to 1 versus the negatives, that marriage is in trouble. It takes 5 positives for every negative. So you need to look, as the caller has just said, kindnesses, compliments, little gifts. I stopped by to pick up something at my wife's office on the way over here, and there sitting there in the door was a little flower. A little flower pot that she'd got me. Little kindnesses make a great deal of difference. But
I'm going to pay for Scott's parking.
There you go. That's great. And I think it also raises the sort of deeper question: what is that kindness? And again, it's a sort of not being self-centered. It's being other-centered, which can take some training. I mean, there are people who just aren't sort of naturally kind.
And isn't it? It's easy to be not kind to the person who you're closest to and you are most comfortable with. You know, you drop a lot of formalities, and sometimes that goes by the wayside too. So it's something, not forgetting to be deliberate with that person above all others.
Well, you talked to Dr. Williams about this, and I want to explore it more deeply, this idea of your wife and being a different person every day, that you're not the same person that you married. And is there something that you have to do consciously to refresh the marriage and to be new to each other every day?
We will get in ruts. I think every couple will get in ruts. And we realize that we have to start doing something different, you know, something new. But I have to be, and she does too, intentional about how we're coming across to the other person. Mm. So that I will consciously force myself not to check after her to make sure she's not screwing up. And she will let me drive. I have to drive.
Okay.
And so we've both made accommodations.
If you drive here, June will pay for your parking.
That's right.
That's a good thing. Well, Liza Whelan, I want to ask you, in long-distance relationships, there's a real danger that you sort of get locked in. I mean, both of you are changing every day, and you're changing apart. But in your mind, you know, it's the person who left you in September. Is it more difficult for you to kind of renew yourself to each other when you're having to live apart for long stretches?
I think, I forget who it was, but somebody talked a minute ago about how intense the, maybe it was you, Frank, about how intense the differences appear when you first get back together with your spouse.
Right.
And I think that was true for us. You know, the first sort of 2 days were just, who are you? Mm-hmm. Why are you still like that? But it got evened out as we were back together. But I don't think we were really conscious until this particular separation was over that was going on. But it was true that you know, things had, and I had, as I say in the essay, moved a little bit towards my old single life, and he didn't, you know, really know that until he read the essay.
Yeah, part of it is recognizing how much you've changed, too. I mean, I think that there's the other person, and then there's a recognition that, oh, my goodness, as I always find that I become extremely self-centered in the course of a week. It doesn't take me, in fact, 5 days. It doesn't take me long at all. Well, I want to thank you all very much. Liza Whelan, who is the author of the essay Preserved in Salt, which is included in the anthology Why I'm Still Married. Liza reads from her new collection of poems Near Alcatraz at the Regulator Bookstore in Durham on Wednesday night, February 15th. Liza, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Dr. Redford Williams is director of the Behavioral Medicine Research Center at Duke University Medical Center. Dr. Williams, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Frank.
And married couple Scott Hewler, and author of several books, most recently Defining the Wind, which is out in paperback. June Spence, author of the novel Change Baby, also out in paperback. Thank you for sharing your hardbound marriage.
Thank you.
This is the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.